I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you on this particular topic. Let me begin by saying that I hadn't planned on being in two institutions when I came here. The opportunity to go back to Texas came up, and I thought it, the adversity was just so much in Virginia that perhaps I ought to move. But this particular study is a study that was done as a part of a cooperative team. There were four of us. Their names are listed. Cynthia Bonner and John Browder and Kelly Oakes were my colleagues, and we were part of a leadership training exercise that lasted a year at Virginia Tech, and we had to have a project, and in picking our project, we decided we would do something that was meaningful, and it was my good fortune that it was more meaningful to the experiment station, perhaps, than the other individuals who are in architecture and in student affairs. But what we decided to do was to take a look at the economy and how changes in the economy are dealt with across the entire system. So we developed a survey instrument to do just that. And if I can, there we go. So the overview of what I'm going to have to say is I'm going to give you a background on state agricultural experiment stations, which I'll keep brief, a description of the budget reduction issues, a case study as we did it, and the project methodology, our results, and then some of the alternative models that we've developed for innovative management of these off-campus facilities. And as we go along, you'll see some pictures of some of the stations that we manage in the Virginia system. Oops, go in the right direction. So as you know, the network of state agriculture experiment stations are part of the land-grant higher education system that were established by the Hatch Act in 1887. We are charged with conducting research and development project on behalf of farmers, and that's farmers with a big F at this point, producers of all sorts, and we have incorporated into agriculture things which weren't traditionally production agriculture, such as turf, nursery, etc., and equine, for example, are all part of this system. And today's research projects and activities are broader, ranging from fundamental to highly applied. And the State Agriculture Experiment Station system, and that title has proven somewhat confusing to people, particularly as we end up with things like NEFA and the like. And so Texas decided through a series of consultants and focus groups to rename the experiment station AgriLife Research and Extension AgriLife Extension. When we first heard about that in Virginia, I ran into Dean Quisenberry's office and I said, hey, this is a great idea. They're branding themselves as AgriLife. We need to do a similar thing. And so what we decided to do was to combine agriculture with innovation and become aggravation. But that didn't pass our board. So in any case, the Virginia Agriculture Experiment Station, or VAES, has over 320 scientists and three colleges that are supported by the system in one way or another, 13 centers around the state, and close interagency coordination between the experiment station and cooperative extension. And the 1890 Virginia State University. Now, one of the things about that's unique about Virginia, as opposed to many other states, is we have one agency, Agency 229, which is funded by the state and encompasses both the experiment station and cooperative extension. And so we have to work together in terms of budget, which actually helps in the decision-making process. This gives you an idea of the locations of our stations around the state. You can see that we cover quite a bit of geography. In the northern part of the state, we're looking at tree fruits and grapes and equine. Towards the eastern part, we actually have a very large vegetable growing region on the eastern shore, seafood, and the traditional row crops down in Suffolk, and our southern Piedmont station, which is focused on tobacco and alternatives to tobacco, and we have some smaller stations such as Northern Piedmont, Shenandoah Valley, Southwest Virginia, which act as stations that visiting faculty use. So one of the real reasons we got into this study was to educate not only the administrators on campus, but also the legislatures of why keep these stations? What relevance do they have today? And an example, a very good example, I think, for Virginia at least, is monitoring soybean rust. Soybean rust can't overwinter in Virginia. It overwinters further south. It's too cold. And it's airborne. It's not vector driven. The timing and effect on crop varies from year to year. And really what the key is you have to have, for soybean rust, a monitoring system so that you apply your fungicides in a timely and purposeful manner. And so far in Virginia, most of the occurrence of soybean rust has occurred too late for it to affect the crop. And so we've saved our producers literally $12 million and the environment from the fungicide simply by monitoring soybean rust, finding out when it appears, and letting people know it's not going to affect your crop, so don't bother. Otherwise, we have our friends in the industry who are selling these products saying, oh, you've got to apply it right away and four times a season, et cetera, et cetera. So we monitor and so forth. And our system, our remote stations across the state, participate in this as well as cooperating farmers. So that's just an example of how this particular system really benefits not only the producers. We could say, well, who cares about the soybean producers? They can fend for themselves. But also, it's very important for a very sensitive part of the state of Virginia, which is the Chesapeake Bay, to keep as many of the pesticides and agrochemicals out of that watershed as possible. So the issue for us was impending state budget reductions. And in 2008-2009, there was a one-time budget reduction of 5%. In 2009-2010, a budget reduction of 5%. Some of that 5% was offset somewhat by the university. So we've actually suffered about a 17% budget reduction in this particular system. And so we needed to really develop a plan to address those ongoing budget reductions. These aren't one time, oh, well, we're just going through a hard time, give us some money back. It's permanent budget reductions from the state budget. So we did this case study project. We administered national survey to explore approaches taken and impacts considered by 49 other directors, and we received 34 responses, which is a 69% response rate. Incredible response rate, very positive, and I thank my colleagues across the whole system for their taking the time to respond to the survey. We compiled the survey data and analyzed it according to recent budget reduction experience. The survey results, we had a regional distribution of respondents. Since Virginia's in the southern section, as you might expect, we had our largest positive response from the southern section, but the northeast, north central, and western regions also responded. And we report recent funding trends. Now, this we found very surprising, that according to this nationwide survey, that there are actually 11 stations that increased, 13% remained stable, and 10% decreased. Now, this was in 2008, so probably there'd be a few more decreases, or at least stable, from these stations. Now, this is why we ask you to sit up front. It gives you a tabular form of or graphic form of the budget reduction strategies. And what we show is the the ways in which people have dealt with these budget reductions. And we looked at these data from, did you actually implement these changes? Have you had budget reductions? Or have you had no budget reductions, but what would you think would be the best way to respond? And by and large, the responses were pretty parallel between the two groups. The closing of individual stations was by far the most widely prescribed solution to budget reductions. And in fact, those that have experienced reduced budgets said that that's a solution. And part of that, and Virginia Tech is now looking at that as a possibility, part of that is to send a message. One of the things that we see time and time again in higher education is that as states' budgets change and there's less funding available to higher education or to the experiment station or to cooperative extension, we just suck it up and say, we're just going to keep doing it. We're going to do it just like we did before. We're just going to do it with less resources. And the closure of individual stations is a way to graphically demonstrate that you can't continue to do it under severe budget reductions. Now, the choice of the station and so forth we'll speak to later. And that ranged reduced budget of select stations, increased charges for sponsored research, reduced budgets across the board, etc., lay off staff, pursue retirements. And I thought that was interesting, that pursuing retirements was not one of the top responses, because a lot of stations, at least that I'm aware of, actually do that. They look at ways to facilitate retirement or incentivize it by buying time into the system. And liquidate property, and that's a very low response, very few percentage-wise in terms of response. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that most of us can't raise money that way. If we, at least in Virginia, and I believe it's the case in Texas as well, we sell a piece of land, the money goes back to the state. So it doesn't really advantage us to do that, per se. The most important influencing factors. Now that we ask the question, well, what factors in your decision-making process are most important to you? And as you might suspect, the state legislature is very high on the list for both the actual and the individuals that haven't experienced reduced budgets. University leadership and governing bodies is very high as well, and I think that's interesting as well because, quite frankly, in many, many cases that we observe, the university administration does not come from the land grant background. We have college presidents who come from all sorts of different backgrounds, liberal arts, industry, et cetera, and so wouldn't necessarily care or know about the off-campus stations. Nevertheless, people are very sensitive to the board of visitors, regents, whatever. Local officials certainly play a role in that. Commodity groups aren't quite as important as one might expect. And then on down to key individual producers. And unfortunately, no one talked about underrepresented populations. And I think that is unfortunate in the sense that there are underserved communities by some of our stations a decision to close down a station should take that into account because we really have to serve the needs of those individuals. How am I doing on time? Somebody needs to keep track. Get the hook. Okay. Okay. All right, thanks. So in summary, the conventional expenditure reduction strategies prevailed. So if you look at the results of what people sent to us, there weren't very many surprises. There weren't any people who said, here's a novel way to approach it or whatnot. Conventional revenue enhancement strategies were secondary. So it's a matter of reduction strategies rather than increasing revenues. And so the idea of charge fee for service or some other way trying to recoup some of the costs were not really explored. As I said, there's no alternative innovative strategy offered, no evidence of thinking outside the box, and basically it looked like brush fire budget management, which quite often is the case because budget reductions often are very sharp and very quick, and your implementation has to be done very suddenly. So the challenge then is how to turn adversity into advantage, and so that's the title of the talk, and what that was four people that sat down and discussed the fact that what was presented was fairly traditional, the results were traditional, the approaches were what you might expect, but are there different ways to manage these budget shortfalls and budget reductions? And so we came up with three different approaches. The examples we use are Virginia Tech in terms of systems, but I'll explain what they mean. There's the corporate research model, and the corporate research center at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg is probably the most successful corporate research park in the country. They are, in fact, completely full, occupied. All their buildings are occupied. They've just purchased some additional land from agriculture to expand the park to build more buildings. They are very successful. And so that model really would just say one way to do this is convert VAES into a quasi-autonomous public-private joint venture. So the corporate research park at Virginia Tech is owned by the foundation. It is an affiliated corporation. It is not part and parcel of a state university. And they can do things that we can't do as a university system. The Commonwealth would provide the land and facilities. There would be corporate sponsorship on a matching basis and sponsored research support as is. The 229 funds, which are the funds from the state, would be used to top off the annual budgets. So that's one possibility. It's to semi-privatize the system. Yes. Got two more examples. That's fine. The Lyric Theater model. The Lyric Theater was one of those grand old theaters in downtown Blacksburg that was in the state of disrepair and was taken over by a group of private citizens as a nonprofit entity, restored, and is run by those nonprofits for the benefit of the community. And so the idea is to convert VAS into a nonprofit entity, which it is anyway. We all lose money, so I guess we're not for revenue rather than not for profit. And have Farm Bureau, individual farmers, and university be the stakeholders which support this enterprise as a nonprofit. There'd be shared financial management and entrepreneurial business plans to emphasize revenue generation. So the idea would be to explore new market opportunities at our stations, international, urban, and so forth. And we have some of that going on as it is now. We have a good partnership with the soybean producers that produce edible soybeans for export to Japan. And so their support's greatly appreciated. Certainly, Philip Morris has been very generous to our Southern Piedmont station in terms of supporting the research that goes on there in terms of tobacco-related research and reducing the risk of tobacco use. And then finally is the farmer cooperative model. And that's basically to convert these stations into joint venture cooperative management entities. Have the farmers as equity shareholders, expand the focus to market storage, marketing, storage, processing, and biotechnology so that they are truly owned by the producers in the region. And then revenues from membership fees and services. And again, you'd need an entrepreneurial business plan. So Those are alternative models that we see as possibilities. The future of off-campus stations is in question, but I think one of the things that I strongly believe in is we do need those boots on the ground. We do need to have that type of research done. We have to convince the folks at NEFA that there is no such thing as basic and applied research. There's only good and bad research, and that applied research or mission-oriented research, which are done at these stations, is critical to the viability of our agricultural industry. So with that, I thank you, and I'll answer some questions.
Let's go ahead and stay up there, Craig.
Yeah.
Craig, I assume that you have some of this discussion going on with the legislature. And what is the nature of that discussion process in terms of them understanding how these outlying stations affect your mission?
Well, one of the things we've started to do, which I strongly urge all of you to do, and that is we've begun holding sessions with key legislatures off the not in the session. Our problem in the past is we've always gone to them during session, where we get our 5 minutes like every other group, and we've become a little bit more proactive in bringing them out to the stations, touring them to a couple places, and not speaking to them from our standpoint, but getting articulate, successful producers to talk to them about the importance of the station to them. And I think that's a much more successful strategy to do. The other thing we've done, because we are part of one agency, is we work very closely with the Extension Leadership Council for the state. And the Extension Leadership Council is a very powerful group of individuals who are very well placed politically and have a very high stake in the extension programs, but they also understand the importance of research. And so this last session we did receive a cut, but it turns out that our cut was less than the universities suffered, and the reason was we finally got the Extension Leadership Council to connect with the legislature to explain to them in the budget committee that we can't raise tuition, because every other time we've received the same cut. If the university got 10%, we got 10%. University would raise 7% in tuition, and we'd be stuck with a full 10%. So they gave us only a 5% cut the last time, but then this latest one, everybody's taken a huge hit. Yes.
After doing the survey, can you give us any what kind of a summary of your surprises? I mean, you went through kind of a list there, and I guess was there anything in there that you really say, well, I really hadn't thought about that, or that's something I really didn't expect in response that maybe a group should consider when they're going through cuts?
No, unfortunately not. That's why we came up with those alternative models at the end. I was surprised because of the nature, certainly in Virginia, and I assume it's true of other states, the dependence on frozen positions and the dependence on retirement incentives, that wasn't higher on the list. Other than that, not really. I think everything. And also, I don't think we as a group don't think about revenue generation. We only think about where we can cut rather than where we can raise funds. Yes?
Well, the faculty very supportive of them paying more for the research support stations.
We have done, so one of the things I can tell you that happened during my watch at Virginia Tech is we had been paying indirect costs on a lot of our grants, but if we got the sponsor to say they don't pay indirect costs, then we could have it waived. But it was a very cumbersome process. process. And what we did was we negotiated with the sponsored programs office. They got, quite frankly, they did a study and they found out that many of the projects and grants have such small amounts of money associated with individual ones that the accounting costs them way more than they would make even if they got full indirect. So what we did is we developed what we called field testing accounts. And field testing accounts basically are any project under $25,000 that are handled by the stations, bear no indirect costs. Okay. However, we've asked the station directors to look at that and to impose a fee, if you will, to capture some of that money up front for the good of the station. So to take 5%, for example, of all of those field testing monies that come in and put that into a pool that can be used for replacing trucks or other equipment at the station or for purchasing certain things. And that's worked out fairly well. The problem is that the amount of money we're generating versus the rate of cuts aren't keeping pace. I will say this, and this is something I'm very proud of. Steve mentioned that that we've been very successful in terms of our NSF rankings for expenditures. What I find more remarkable is that our off-campus faculty per FTE are actually more successful than our on-campus on average. They're bringing in $128,000 on average per year in grant funds versus $125,000. Now that's all over the block, and the ones off campus don't bring in indirects. So of course the university doesn't like that. But in terms of doing what I ask them to do and what I feel is the most important function of a research director, and that is you love what you do, you love to do research, we can't provide the funds, find them yourself and we'll help you. That's really the key to it. It doesn't matter how much it is, what matters is you can wake up in the morning and you can go out and do what you love to do. And I can't imagine anything more frustrating as a scientist than not being able to do the work that I love to do. Don't do it anymore, but not having the grant funding to do that, whether it be industry money or commodity money or a competitive grant. So that's kind of the philosophy that we've developed, and it's worked pretty well, particularly with our incoming faculty. Our young faculty have bought into it. Yeah.
In our state, there's some talk about establishing station endowments. Do you have any experience or any, through your survey or interaction, any thoughts on that?
I think that would be a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. I know that in Texas, there is an endowment for the Dallas station. But in Virginia, no, none of them are endowed. We did. During my tenure there, we got a new plant science building, which through a naming opportunity became endowed, and that money goes to equipment replacement and graduate student stipends. I think it's a great idea. The problem is, given the economy and how low the return on an endowment is, it'll take a while to get that in place, but it's a good idea.
Have any suggestions on those models that you present, whether one of them is your favorite?
Actually, you know, my favorite model is to have the federal government and state governments man up and pay for it. Because the fact of the matter is, agriculture is the only essential industry. Take any other industry, you know, we can get by without automobiles. Maybe, not Texas, but the fact is, you know, we need food and fiber, we need shelter, we need all the things that are in agriculture and natural resources, and we also need to be able to be secure in that as a country. We do not want to have happen to our food supply what happened to our energy supply, where we're dependent on a small group of people who may have political ideas and manipulate us. So I think, as a matter of national security, and the fact that the health, and this is key to what Roger was saying this morning, the health of the country will depend on what we put in our bodies, and we haven't really begun to scratch the surface on the our ability to use food as a healthcare type of approach. Our biggest problem is that we eat too much processed food and too much of it. And if we can just eat healthier and so forth, I've always talked to the plant breeders about getting that carrot that tastes like a chocolate bar, but they haven't managed to do it yet. It's time for a break, guys.
Well, let's give